Everyone, and we are back to our survey of the Old Testament and looking forward to this next session. Let me say something about the readings. So our congregational readings this year, they're not over the whole Old Testament. They're over the history of Israel in the Old Testament, which is a huge portion of the Old Testament, but it's not everything. And so that's why we picked up the readings in Exodus. So when we started this survey of the whole Old Testament, not just the history of Israel, you could say the history of Israel is sort of the hub of this survey. But when we started the survey, we started back in Genesis. So when we started surveying, the reading was ahead of us. And then we caught up to the reading, and we were talking about the Exodus about the time we were reading about the Exodus. Well, now our survey is going to pass up our readings. So we've just been reading some sample chapters in Numbers. We're going to read in Deuteronomy, which is when the new generation is reminded or even given the law by Moses before they go into the land of Canaan, which is what we're going to talk about today. And so actually what you're going to be reading the next couple weeks is what the children of Israel were taught and reminded of before they do what we're going to look at today. And we've got another video coming out here in the next several days when I do my part, when I finish my part on it. That's going to talk about the law, and it really fits reading the book of Deuteronomy, or at least part of the book of Deuteronomy, because Deuteronomy is sometimes called, you know, it means literally second law. And so it's good to keep the law in mind. Actually, as you study all of Israelite history, you need to remember the law, because the law is sort of the basis of their, it's the basis of their relationship with God, and so it always is relevant. So that's where we're at. So our survey is going to surpass our reading so that as we survey the Old Testament, later on we'll come to those parts of the Bible that we've already surveyed in our reading, and hopefully that will enhance even your reading. So great to be together. Daryl, would you lead us in a prayer as we start?
Our Father in heaven, we're thankful to be able to be here this morning, to assemble together, to study a portion of your word, and thankful that you've given us your word, which is a guide to us, to help us in our daily lives. We're thankful that you've given us the history of the Old Testament to help us understand your divine guidance and your plan for redemption and salvation of mankind. We pray that as we study, you will help us to learn and understand things that will be helpful to us. Be with Philip as he conducts the class. Help him to be effective, and help us as listeners to be attentive. In Christ's name we pray.
Amen.
So if you're working with your timeline, this is where we're at. We've just recently been studying about the Exodus, but last week we looked at this period called the Wilderness Wanderings, where the first generation out of Egypt, because of their lack of faith in taking the Canaan land, were cursed. They were judged, and they would perish in the wilderness over a 40-year period, and a new generation would arise and replace the leadership. And so the Wilderness Wanderings, I think, is a narrative part of the Old Testament. As far as the history of the Old Testament, it's probably one of the most neglected parts because it is rich, the wanderings are. And remember what we were talking about last week, the main point we made last week is that period of traveling between Egypt to Canaan is not about a geographic trip. The purpose was not just to get into Canaan. The purpose was to make them into the people of God. And some people were filtered out because they were not. They didn't want to be the people of God. And so we're going to talk about the conquest of Canaan today. Sounds like a military term, and it is somewhat of a military operation. And so the chief character that we'll see right off the bat here is going to be Joshua. So there's the update to your timeline regarding what we've just been talking about and what we're going to talk about today. And the conquest of Canaan is an exciting time, really, in the history of Israel and the survey of the Old Testament. So let's jump in here and look, first of all, at the developments. And the first thing we see right off the bat has to do with them entering the land of Canaan, but also the leadership aspect that's changing. So by the time we get to Joshua chapter 1, Moses has died. And look what is communicated here. Earl, would you read for us the first 9 verses of chapter 1, please?
Yeah, Joshua 1, 1 through 9. This is the launch of the conquest.
Now, it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, to the sons of Israel. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, even as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, as far as the great sea, toward the setting of the sun, will be your territory. No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it, for then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go."
All right, thank you. From a reading standpoint, there's something within us when we look at this and we look at the first statement of this exciting event that's going to take place. And it's like, Moses is not with them. As a reader, it would make sense to us that Moses, who had gone through so much with these people, who had been their leader in the deliverance from Egyptian bondage and through all the trials of the wilderness, that he doesn't get to go with them. I mean, this is not how we would write the story, right? Why isn't Moses with them?
Because he failed to treat God as holy in front of the people.
Great answer. I think we may have talked about that text before sometime in the last year, but a lot of people get hung up on striking the rock and speaking to the rock. That had nothing to do with the issue. The issue was God told him, there back in the book of Numbers, "You didn't treat me as holy," because Moses says, must we fetch you water, you rebels? He was providing the water? No. He didn't treat God as holy. Only God could provide water from a rock like that. And so, it's in a way severe, but it's God's judgment, and Moses is not going to lead him in. So he dies on the other side of the Jordan, and now Joshua is the leader. Joshua, when you look at the list of Bible characters, he's not as fleshed out as, say, an Abraham or a Moses or a David. He's in that next tier, and we know quite a bit about him. And pretty much everything we know is portrayed in Scripture as incredibly positive. We're not to assume he was perfect in the sense of flawless, but he is a model of faith from the beginning when we're introduced to him, serving as an assistant to Moses in the wanderings and as a spy to the land of Canaan. He and Caleb had the faith about taking the land. And then, as we'll see his leadership through this book, he is just a model of faith and leadership. He's one of the great leaders of biblical times. But in this text right here, what does God keep telling him over and over? Be courageous. Don't fear. And what was the basis for Joshua being courageous? What does God tell him over and over? I'm with you. So Joshua knew the kind of land they were invading. He knew it had fortified cities, strong peoples, and some big people. And so God is with them. And that tells us something about leadership. Leadership needs support. Okay? Strengthening. It's really easy among God's people to think, well, that person's a leader. Their job is just to make all the rest of us strong. It goes both ways. They need support too. And so the first thing that happens in the conquest book is that God is bolstering Joshua. God is supporting Joshua. He's strengthening Joshua because Joshua's leadership is going to be needed. So they're going to go into the land of Canaan, the promised land. And this is the beginning of the conquest. And I want you to get the tension, and I don't mean tension in a bad way. I mean tension in a good way. The energy of the moment probably is a better way to say it. Because now they're going to set foot in the promised land that had been promised to Abraham nearly 500 years before. And most recently, they had been delivered from Egyptian bondage, and they were headed to the Canaan land. And they were really on the threshold of going into the Canaan land when the spies came back and 10 of them had the bad report. And so now they had to wait another 40 years. And I'm sure that 40 years in a way felt like the 400, not quite. But it's like there's this tension that's built up, this energy that's built up. And now it's unleashed. And it's going to happen. The action's going to happen. And so this is a lot of pent-up energy and anticipation right here. And I want you to understand what they're going into. We see in the second chapter, when Joshua has spies sent into the land of Canaan, specifically to look at Jericho, because Jericho was at, they're going, and we're going to look at a map in a moment. They're going in at the central part, okay, at the east central part of the land of Canaan. And Jericho is the first fortified city, and it is a tough city. Matter of fact, Jericho, according to archaeological digs, is one of the oldest cities that we know about in human history. It's old. And so this is like entrenched. This is an entrenched city. And so he sends spies in that get help from Rahab the harlot. And this is what Rahab has to say. And this is what's motivating her to assist the Israelite spies. Chapter 2, verse 8 to 13. Zachary, can you read that for us?
Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is the God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as you have dealt kindly with me, or as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, if you understand how the biblical history flows, you know that Rahab becomes part of the Israelite community, marries, and is actually in the lineage of Jesus, according to Matthew 1. This is a shocker, okay? She was Jericho's harlot, or at least one of them. But she is an honest witness. What had she heard about these people?
The great things that God had already done.
All these things we've been studying about the Egyptian bondage and deliverance from it and the miracles and all this. And that had started 40 years before. And so what I want you to see from this is that these are well-known events. Without telephones, cell phones, internet, telegraph, okay, any of this kind of stuff, the word had gotten into the land of Canaan about these people who had been miraculously delivered by the hand of their God. And people were fearing this God. And this was all on purpose. And so understand that It's not like today, obviously, but people were connected with things that happened. They probably knew more about things that were happening than we give them credit. And so look at the advantage that the Israelites have. In a way, God has already gone before them to prepare. And this is going to, in a way, we'll see this later, simplify the process of taking the land of Canaan. And so let's talk about Jericho here for a moment and look at this statement here. Joshua chapter 6, verses 1 to 5. Ken, can you read that for us? Joshua 6, 1 to 5. So they're going to come, and this is going to be the first city, first big operation of taking the land of Canaan.
Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out, and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king, and the mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go all around the city once. This you shall do 6 days. And seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priest shall blow the trumpets. It shall come to pass, when they make a long blast with the ram's horns, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all of the people shall shout with a great shout. Then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, every man straight before him."
All right, thank you. We'll talk more in a moment about city-states. But in ancient times, you had these cities that were fortified with walls. And before Canaan, this was the best protection. And what you would do if you were threatened, you would shut the gates, bar the gates, and you would, if you were properly planned, you had a water source from within or water reserves, and you had food reserves, and you would wait it out. And so the army would lay siege to the city, and you would just wait it out. Sometimes it could go months and months and months. And in many cases, this worked, and the army just went on, okay? Because the longer it took, then the army became, unrest and things like that. It was hard to breach these really good walled-up cities. The Romans got good at it with things like catapults, but this was a good way to do that. So this is exactly what's happened. They walled up this, they shut the gates, nobody could get in and out, and they're just going to wait this out. After all, Jericho is an old city. They've done this before. But they've never encountered this kind of enemy before. Because what's going to be taken out? The walls. They're just going to fall down. So this is what the Israelites are told. All right, here you are. You're going to take the land of Canaan. And here's what you're going to do. You're going to march around this wall with the ark and blowing trumpets once a day. And on the seventh day, seven times. And then the walls are just going to fall down. I would have you see that this right here was a test. A test of what? They're going to trust God that this is the way to do it. Can you imagine? And by this point, you're starting to see this, and Joshua is one of them, that they're developing some people with military strategies because they've already had some battles before they get to Jericho, and they've been successful generally. Can you imagine the military minded among them saying, let's think about this here. I don't think that's how we ought to take it. But they don't. They do this just as God tells them to. And as the song says, the walls came tumbling down. Okay, it's a great song, isn't it? So this was, and this right here shows us the nature of the conquest. You're going to see with the next cities that it's going to be a traditional method of taking the cities. They're going to, entice the armies to come out and things like that. They're going to use tactics. They're going to flank them. They're going to draw them out and all that kind of thing. And so they're going to have some traditional military tactics. But what this conquest is going to involve is a combination of God intervening in a supernatural way. And he does it on more than one occasion. This is one of the most dramatic ones. As well as the people having to draw their swords and fight. And exert their energy and make an effort. And risk themselves in a battle. So it's a combination of God working for them and them working with God. And that's how the land of Canaan is going to be taken. So, you know, that's it's a unique kind of thing there. It combines both. So, but after this great victory at Jericho, and a great victory it was, they have a problem, because the next city they tried to take, Ai, they are defeated, and they learn there's a problem in the camp of the Israelites. What's the problem? It's with this man. What's the problem? Okay. They were commanded that regarding the goods of Jericho, that what? Not to take them. Not to take the spoils. They were going to be dedicated to the Lord. So they were somehow used with the tabernacle worship and the priesthood and those kinds of things. They were not to take personal spoils. Now, later on, they're going to get all kinds of spoils. And they're going to get, you know, they're going to take, have wells they never dug and vineyards they never planted. But for Jericho, this was to be set apart. This was to be holy. But Achan grabbed some stuff. Some precious metal, garments, etc. And he hit it. And look what happens here. Because this is really a testimony of what these people were like and where they're at. Andrew, can you read that for us? Chapter 8, verse 22 to 26, please. I got the wrong passage, sorry. It should be chapter 7, not chapter 8. My bad. That's chapter 7, 22 to 26. My bad.
So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran to the tent. And there it was hidden in this tent, with the silver under it. And they took them from the midst of the tent, brought them to Joshua and to all the children of Israel, and laid them out before the Lord. And Joshua and all of Israel with him took Achan the son of Zerah, the silver, the garment, the wedge of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all that he had. And they brought them to the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." So all Israel stoned him with stones, and they burned him with fire after they stoned him with stones. Then they raised over him a great heap of stones, still there to this day. So the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor to this day.
All right, thank you. Sorry for the mix-up.
We've seen in the Wilderness Wanderings a similar scenario, and that is, they're moving along, and some offense is made against God, and God has to punish because of it. How is this one different than the ones we encountered back in Exodus and Numbers, like the golden calf incident and the murmuring about food and the Korah's rebellion and all that? What differences do you see, Zach?
God's not the one directly punishing.
He punishes them with the Ai failure, but who's taking the initiative to address this problem? It's not God, is it?
You mean it's Joshua?
It's Joshua.
Actually perform the punishment.
And the people. Joshua and the people are purging this problem from among them.
And how many were involved in this? It's one man. Yeah, and his household suffers. And maybe his household were complicit. But one family. In the other incidents, you find them over and over and over in the book of Numbers. It's like large numbers of people. Sometimes the whole group of Israel, like in the case of the spies, the bad report, I mean, the bulk of the people, you know, turned on Joshua and Caleb and wanted to stone them. So look how different this is. This is a problem. This is a contamination. But it's very limited. And very quickly, the Israelites do what? They surgically remove it. It's extracted. When before, it was a problem that just took off, okay? I mean, there's this over and over and over, like the sin with Baal on the threshold of the Canaan land, and they're involved in sexual morality with some of the locals and all that kind of stuff, in large numbers, and this is a disease. And back in the Numbers, you read about pandemics of sin. And this is immediately caught and extracted and dealt with. Do you see a different generation of people here? The generation of Israelites in the book of Joshua, it's a sterling generation. I'm not saying they're perfect, and they're not, in the sense of flawless, but they are exceptional among generations of Israelites. I think the generation of Israelites during the days of David's reign would be close, because you read a similar kind of mentality among them. And again, leadership was critical. But this one, they even had greater tests. And they're passing the tests. They really are passing them. So the Achan incident is not just there, you know, it's not just, and it teaches the lesson that, you know, one person sinning affects a lot of, and that's fine, that's a sermon we'll preach kind of thing. I think what it shows more than anything is not the problem with Achan. It shows the good qualities of the Israelites and how they dealt with it. And how that this problem, think about that. You think Achan was the only one tempted to grab some stuff? No. But nobody else did. That's pretty good, isn't it? That's really good. Because Jericho had a lot of spoils. It was just that kind of city. Rick, did you have your hand up?
I was thinking of Ananias and Sapphira. That's a pretty good parallel there. They come into the promised land, the first thing they have is a problem, and they deal with it. And the church, establishment of the church, and they have a problem.
They found out, too.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel. It really is. And I think that this is severe, the reaction to Achan, just like the Ananias and Sapphira thing was severe, but it's timing. It's at a time when it's crucial to get this right. And this can't be allowed to contaminate the situation. So let's talk about the conquest a little bit from just a factual standpoint. Look with me here in Joshua 3. Ray, will you read verse 10 over in Joshua 3? We're going back to before they come across the River Jordan. And we're only hitting the highlights here. But look at a statement made to Joshua in Joshua 3, verse 10.
Or by Joshua.
And Joshua said, "Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will, without fail, drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites."
All right, thank you. So that's interesting. It's very revealing here. So let's talk about the facts of the situation. First of all, Canaan was a region. It's not a political entity, like with a king or a government. It's a region. It's like saying Europe. It's like saying Central America. It's a region filled with different kinds of people ethnically and with different government arrangements. And that's why you have this list here, you know, isn't how convenient that it rhymes. You know, the Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, Termites, just seeing if you're listening. Can't help that. These are all different groups of people with different backgrounds and different organizations and so forth, socially and government-wise, which in a way is going to make this easier, but in a way, maybe not. What you've got here in the land of Canaan, which is something very common for this period, this is like, in a way, Iron Age, okay? And this is very common for this period in this time of the world. These are city-states. And city-states go all the way back in early ancient history, like places like where Abraham came from, like Ur. And there were all kinds, if you saw the video on the Fertile Crescent, all kinds of city-states up and down the Fertile Crescent. But city-states hang around for a while. For instance, Rome is an example of the last great city-state, and it actually is a city-state on steroids. And that is, you have a city where everything is centralized, the economic activity and the political activity, and then it's so powerful that it radiates authority outside its walls and it incorporates the land around it. It's in a way similar to the idea of, like, if somebody asks me, if I go travel somewhere, if I'm in California or Oregon, and somebody says, "Where are you from?" And I say, "I live in Asheville, North Carolina." Well, I don't live in Asheville, North Carolina. I live in Weaverville, okay? But, right? So Asheville has this radiating kind of, you know, authority and so forth. And so thus it was with city-states. And so you'd have a king of that city-state, and if he was very powerful, he would have control of the land all around it, far and wide. And of course, the goods would come in and the goods would go out and those kinds of things. That's what you've got here with the land of Canaan. And so you've got various people And some of these terms are very, very general. Some are very specific, like the Jebusites were those just around Jerusalem. Is Hittites in this list? Yeah, Hittites is in this list. But there was a concentration of Hittites in the land of Canaan, but there were Hittites all over the place. There were Hittites up near, like what we would call Turkey today. They were just sort of scattered around, and they were very advanced and very fierce people, by the way, very technologically savvy, the Hittites were. So you got a lot of different people. Now, there were three, in a way, three campaigns, if you look at this. So the first thing that happens here is that they cross the River Jordan, and Jericho is the first city they take. As you can see, they're going into the central part. From a military standpoint, that's probably not the best move. But they've got God on their side. You don't need Patton and Napoleon. You got God. So you're going to do it God's way, and it's going to work. Okay? Because really, this is taking on the strength if you attack the center. You always try to attack the flanks. So they're going to come here to Jericho. They take Jericho. And immediately after taking Jericho and then Ai on the second attempt, everybody in Canaan is shaking in their boots. And what happens here is that then you have a southern campaign. And there is a group of southern city-states that form a coalition. And they're like, the only way we're going to be able to defend ourselves against these Israelites is to form a coalition, sort of like a NATO organization. And we're going to stand up against the Israelites this way. Doesn't work. And then there is a northern coalition that says, aha, and it was led by a king way up here in Hazor, way up in here, okay? And so they form a coalition to try to stop Israel, and it doesn't work. And so central campaign, southern campaign, the northern campaign, and that's how Canaan falls. And it happens over a good period of time. And there are really three phases to this campaign. And the first two you read about in the book of Joshua, and that is you have this general subduing of the region. That involves defeating the main city-states. That involves defeating the main opposition military units, like the one formed by the Southern Coalition, the one formed by the Northern Coalition. So you're basically, you're winning the big battles. And then a good chunk of the book of Joshua is about then allotting tribal territory. So you got 12 sons of Israel. Levi is going to be the priestly tribe. They will not have a land allotment, obviously because of Joseph's role and so forth. Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, then take his spot and Levi's spot. And so these are the tribes that you have. You have Manasseh, Ephraim, and then all the other tribes that you read about from the sons of Israel or Jacob, Judah, and Issachar, and Simeon, and so forth. And so the tribes are allotted their territories very specifically. And then there were pockets of Canaanites. Canaanite is a generic term. It's like saying European. Oh, do you mean the Swiss or the Germans or the Italians? Canaanites, that's a general term. So there were still pockets of Canaanites. And so the individual tribes, as they took their land allotment, would mop it up, would remove them. And this is where you have, we talked about this the other day with Caleb, he's part of the tribe of Judah, right? Caleb is. And so he's 80-some years old. And he says, give me that hill country. Because that's where the Anak are there. That's the giant warriors. That's who I want to take on. Because I remember that God promised us this land. I mean, Caleb's the guy. To me, if I'm around Caleb, I want to get behind Caleb and say, let's go. I'm behind you. Let's go. You lead. I'm all the way. And let's go up into those hills and let's take on those giants. Into the hills and against the giants. He's 80-some years old. So he's got to love him. He's got to love Caleb. So that's how the land is taken there in those phases. So before we talk about themes and meeting, any comments or observations or questions about this? Yeah, Earl.
Thinking about these men that are going in here and taking this land. A lot of them were in diapers when their parents were faithless and saying that they would be prey to the Canaanites. Now they're in, with God's help, conquering the Canaanites.
Great observation.
Thank God when you have parents who help you in the Lord. But your parents don't define you in your faith. And these people were an example of that. Yeah, right.
Well, you were talking about Rahab's reaction. I've often wondered what it must have been like. Climb up on a mountain and you see 2 million people out there camped around this tent. And they're moving around throughout the country for 40 years. I mean, how could they not have known what about this people?
Yeah. And you're in Jericho and you're peering over the wall. And their attack method is to blow trumpets and walk around with this box. It's a fancy looking box, the ark, but, and then the walls fall. It's complete anomaly here how everything is done, for the most part. I mean, a lot of it's not. So yes, Gary.
Go back to the previous slide. Yeah, that, you see the arrow where he crosses the Jordan River there.
Right here. Yeah,
where Jericho is.
Tell us about it.
When we were over there, we went to Jericho and to the ancient city, the ruins of the ancient city there. Modern city is about 4 or 5 miles away right now. But from the ancient city, you're right in the foothills of the mountains that go up to Jerusalem and everywhere. And this is kind of built, the ancient city is kind of up the slope a little bit. So when you turn and look back toward the Jordan, it's like looking down through a delta. It's just a flat area across there for about 5 miles over to the Jordan River. So when the children of Israel came across, they're very visible to any of the inhabitants there in Jericho. I mean, you're going to see, just like
the first time,
you're going to see all this mass of people coming toward you.
Yeah. And it's a front door attack.
Yeah.
It's not a sneak attack, is it?
No, not part of it.
And not only that, they enter the land of Canaan with the River Jordan behind them. Not a good military tactic. Because what if you have to, what if we have to retreat? You got to get everybody across the Jordan. But, you know, they didn't cross the Jordan like anybody else. Right? It was dry land when they crossed it. So thank you for that. And Rick, you're exactly right. And great observations there. So, there we go. So let's talk about some of the big ideas here. First of all, faithfulness. If numbers is so much about the Israelites demonstrating their unfaithfulness, Joshua is so much about them demonstrating their faithfulness. But it's not just the Israelites, right? We've talked about that. The real story here is whose faithfulness. What is this survey about? Whose faithfulness is demonstrated in the conquest? God's faithfulness. He promised this land to their ancestors nearly 500 years before this. And he's giving it to them. And he's making this possible. And it shows, the conquest shows that the covenant is working. I'll bless you as my people. Your enemies will be my enemies. I'll curse those who curse you. I'll bless those who bless you. You need to do what I say. They do what he says, and he blesses them here. He gives them victory. And so this is a great demonstration of that. It's also from a broad standpoint, because you've got this idea, and this is what you can do as we do a survey. You know, we focus in on Israel, but there's always the big picture, and that is God and humanity, period. And this is a demonstration that God is not just working his plan for the Israelites. He's also working a plan for the Girgashites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and everybody else. And I'm just going to mention it real quickly because it's time. But, you know, in Genesis chapter 15, God tells Abraham that your descendants are going to go in and they're going to be oppressed. Talking about the Egyptian bondage. But then they're going to come out. And I'm going to give him the land of Canaan. And he says there to Abraham, the iniquity of the Amorites is not full, basically is what God says there. And the Amorites is another one of these generic terms that would apply to almost all these people living in Canaan. It's like saying Caucasians or something. It's like saying Latinos, and that might be, you know, somebody from Guatemala or somebody from, you know, Chile or something. So it's a generic term, Amorites and Canaanites. And it's not yet complete. It's not complete yet. So, you know, this is critics of the Bible, especially vicious critics of the Bible, they love the book of Joshua. Because they like to make God out to be this vicious, bloodthirsty, you know, deity and so forth. God's been trying to bring these people around to repentance for centuries. This is not, an impromptu act on God's part. This is a plan of judgment. Because it's funny, because the same people who criticize that God is bloodthirsty in Joshua also says, how can you believe in God when there's so much evil in the world and he's doing nothing about it? Well, he's doing something about it right here. But guess what? He does it when he wants to. He does it when the time is right. He does it in his perfect judgment. And so this is a judgment on the people of Canaan. And it's going to be a severe judgment, and the instrument will be the Israelites. Yeah, Joe?
Philip, the people of Canaan had time to get out of there. Because obviously Rahab knew that God had given them the land, so obviously they were aware of what was going on.
Right. So they did.
They stayed to their own.
And you have to understand how wicked these people were. I mean, child sacrifice was common. I'll give you an idea.
And any one of them could have turned to the Lord just like Rahab.
Right. And listen, this is, I would propose to you that this is the only time that God has authorized one people taking the land from another. People who first settled the United States from England, a lot of them love to go back to the Old Testament and say, see these barbaric Native Americans? We deserve their land. We're the true Israel, not them. And they justify taking Indian lands by passages like this. Okay? You know, guess what? They weren't carrying an Ark of the Covenant when they did it, the pilgrims. They weren't carrying an Ark of the Covenant because they were not Israel. This is different. This is unique. And in the New Testament, we are spiritual Israel. And our battles are spiritual, not territorial, not flesh and blood. And so this is a unique thing, but it is God sanctioning this land being purged from these wicked people and given to Israel. Yes?
And we're also commanded to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You want someone taking our land?
Yeah, that doesn't work well, does it? It's real. I tell you what it is. It's a failure. This is a very fundamental doctrinal thing. It's a failure to understand that today we're the spiritual Israel. And it's not about Jerusalem and all these kinds of things that people get hung up on. We're a spiritual kingdom. That's where it really turns.
Yeah. It is a spiritual battle. Jesus said, put up the sword. Those who know the sword die by the sword. Put up a physical sword.
Yeah.
Your sword is a spiritual sword.
Exactly. The sword is spirit. Exactly.
And so many texts that make that plain in the New Testament. So many texts. But this was, I mean, if you were a follower of God right here, you pulled the real sword out. That's how it was. But that's not God's permanent plan. This, you know, we're living in God's permanent plan now. And then the other thing is, the last chapter is beautiful. We just have time to hit it just really quickly. The last chapter is beautiful, Joshua 24. And if you think about it, all through the book of Numbers, Moses is pleading with the Israelites, follow God in Exodus. Follow God, follow God, follow God. After they take the land and Joshua is addressing the people as a farewell, he tells them, you can't serve this God. He's too holy. And the people beg, no, we will serve God. It's such a flip. Moses is telling them, please serve God and respect God and follow his will. And the people are, you know, resisting and bucking that and kicking against that. Joshua says, all right, after they've proven to be the most faithful generation, Joshua says, choose who you're going to serve today, whether it's the Lord or the God of your fathers or whatever. And they said, we want to serve the Lord. But Joshua says, no, he's holy. You can't serve the Lord. No, we will serve the Lord. We promise to serve the Lord. And I will just read this as we end. This is what it says. This helps to put an exclamation point on what we've been saying about this generation. This is Joshua 24, verse 31. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the work that the Lord did for Israel. Okay. We'll keep going next week. Thank you.